Hello, and welcome to the fifth night of Millennial 2021. And I'm here now with a very special guest, quite high profile, and one that I know a lot of people have looked forward to. And that is James Dellingpole, the journalist. Now, I've known of James for a long time. I was just chatting to him and saying that I remember reading his articles in the Daily Telegraph back in 2007, and through the whole climate change thing and that was going on at that time. It's a different world now, but we were thinking that we would just wax nostalgic about that and talk about how Britain has changed over the last 15 years. So, James, welcome to Millennial, and thank you for appearing.
Thank you, Colin. It's really great to be on your show, and thank you for asking me.
So, well, you're welcome. I was very pleased to secure this. Let's talk about Britain in 2005, because that seems like a good... That was a bit of a pivotal moment in itself, because I think that was when the right... and obviously you could choose any year and say that that's a defining moment there and there. But I think 2005 for me is pivotal, because it seems like the moment in time when the right really ceased to be culturally confident and dominant. Not that it was before that, but it's like that's the point where the left started. See, in the 90s, the left was pro-freedom of speech and anti-censorship. But from about 2005 onwards, that position was reversed. And the left started talking about censoring people, punishing people for what they say. And the right went on the defensive. So I think that's around about 2005 with the Equalities Act. That's around the time when that power switch seems to have, you could say it took place around that time. So the new left, new Labour, really infiltrated all of these institutions in throughout that first 5 years, eight years. And then around that time, you've got this, a new Britain, in a sense. What would you say about that?
Do you know what? I think if we'd had this discussion 10 years ago, I would have agreed with all that. But now I think that it's always been an illusion. The idea that there is the left and the right, and that the blue party does, the one with the blue rosette does, you know, believes in patriotism and I don't know, tradition and limited government, and the left believes in wealth redistribution and you know, sort of political correctness and stuff. I'm really not sure that those are actually an accurate depiction of what is. We were talking about Telegraph blogs, and I think that was a watershed moment, because that, for me anyway, and I think you know, you were saying that Morgoth was also one of the commenters, one of the readers of I mean, it was the beginning of this new world we live in now, the new media world, where people like you and me and Morgoth have been driven into the margins, like, you know, we've been driven into like King Alfred, you know, hiding in the marshes because that we're surrounded by Vikings. Is it Vikings? Yeah.
I don't know, but it seems likely.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the end of my career in the mainstream media, because even though the Telegraph blogs were this, you know, attached to the Telegraph, they were very much a separate entity, and they were much edgier than the Telegraph, which already at that stage was going, I call it the Guardian graph. It was becoming the Guardian graph even then. And that was the time when I was able to kind of write interesting, edgy stuff. Yeah, I mean, stuff pushing the boundaries of the Overton window, like the Climategate story that I helped break.
Well, that's why the blogs were so popular and why they were a hotbed of activity in the comments section, because they were more edgy, more interesting, and also more concise than the main articles on the main site. You know, there was no sort of waffle.
You could really cut loose. I mean, it was a glorious period where it looked like we were reinventing the media. That we could say the unsayable, we could say it in a relaxed, groovy way. And we had a lot of feedback from our readers, but below the line. It was great. It was a community. But it didn't last very long. I mean, I don't know, the powers that be at the Telegraph did not feel comfortable with this. Because the Telegraph was getting incredibly woke. There was some ghastly woman with some pointless title like, oh, I don't know, sort of digital content. I forget what her title was, but she was basically a politically correct commissar who was there to enforce political correctness on us. And I just thought, fuck this shit. I mean, I remember, what was that? The deputy editor of, that's right. It was when I had my first experience of the Twitch hunt mob, you know, on Twitter, being mobbed and realizing that your career is hanging by a thread. Do you remember this? You probably don't.
Well, when was it? Because I used Twitter in between 2015 and 18, really.
Okay. Well, it was one of the early moments where you realized that the world had changed and the world had changed forever. And I'd been pottering along, imagining that things were, you know, the world was changing, but it hadn't changed radically, because we all expect the world to be pretty much like it was last year, not radically different to how it was last year, but there were various signposts on the way. So I remember Suzanne Moore had tweeted out something typically fatuous, you know, some sort of rancid Guardian piss that she'd written an article, and you just thought, this is absolute horseshit. This is just revolting. And so I tweeted out something rude and misogynistic and sexual, something about I forget the exact phrase, but it was a sort of insulting thing about Suzanne Moore. And she decided to play the victim card. She decided to try and claim that what I'd done effectively was I'd pretty much raped her. I mean, I hadn't literally raped her, because that wouldn't be quite possible on Twitter, but to all intents and purposes, I had raped her. And I thought, well, this is going to go away, because it's bloody ridiculous, because words don't rape you. There is a difference between physical assault and sort of tasty language. Maybe it was misogynistic, but it won't rape Suzanne. And then I had the Guardian lawyers on me, and I had the deputy editor of the Telegraph, Benedict Brogan, was married to a woman called Melanie Dawes. And Melanie Dawes is the head of Ofcom. She's very powerful. She was, you know, a senior civil servant then. I mean, abominably woke. But Melanie was a childhood friend of mine. I mean, she was like, you know, I never went out with her, but we were very close. And I used to go to all her parties and stuff, and we liked each other. And it was weird seeing this person you'd known in your youth as an ordinary, friendly person that you could have even gone off with her. Suddenly, years on, there she is, embedded in the system. She's part of the deep state, an integral part of the deep state. And she's trying to get you sacked because of a tweet. I mean, she was agitating to Ben Brogan to get me sacked. And weirdly enough, I mean, this is the kind of crazy world we live in. One of the people that sort of pleaded for me to keep my job. This is a very ill-paid job on Telegraph blogs. You know, it wasn't like a Daily Mail column. It was a really, really shit money, really tight. And I was bringing in them loads of traffic, and I was getting paid peanuts for this. And they were thinking of taking my job away from me because of a tweet.
When was this? Just in
2007, 2008, 2009, 2010.
Right. So it's very early then in all of this.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's okay. The thing. In the same way, there were these pointers. I mean, I hope you don't mind me rambling in whatever direction because it's my preferred.
That's my fine. Just mode. Don't be offended if I can't sometimes ask a question like that. So that way, you know, I should have done that sooner.
Don't cut anything I say. It's all great. What was I going to say about the?
Benjamin Brogan.
So anyway, I somehow clung on to my job by groveling and stuff, which I would never do again. I think this is the mistake that Toby Young makes. You should never apologize to these cunts because they are evil, and when you give them blood, they want more blood. That's the thing. It's always that they are never satisfied with their pound of flesh.
Absolutely. This is something I've found recently as well through my similar experiences in my own sphere. If you're too nice to people and if you try to please them, try to placate them, try to calm them down and assure them that you're not their enemy, they just hate you in response. It's a really strange thing about human nature.
Yeah. And I can tell talking to you that you have nothing to prove on the niceness front. You're an intelligent, thoughtful, sensitive human being. You don't need to apologize to yourself. You don't need to excuse yourself. And yet that's what they want. They want to make you feel like shit.
But when you do apologize to them or try to placate them or whatever, it doesn't work, and it doesn't shut them up, and it doesn't make them see sense or anything. They just want more and more and more. They want to just keep breaking you down. And this is why it's the best idea is just to stick to your guns from the start.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No prisoners. No prisoners. You've got to keep your place in the shield wall and die fighting if that's what is necessary. There's no other way. These people are scum. I mean, they are evil. And I think when you understand that, then you acquire the right mindset, which is that no prisoners. You can't.
I think the thing is they interpret it as weakness. If you're trying to appease them or just be reasonable with them, they interpret that as weakness, and then it's blood in the water. But it must be strange for you because you, as you've already alluded to, you've mentioned one person whom you knew in the before time, who yes. you were close to, and you've seen that person morph into a politically correct apparatchik, a node of the system, yes. as it were. That must be a very strange, and you know, it's actually interesting that I have a slightly similar story in that I was at art college. There was a girl there and we were very close, and she got back in touch with me several times. Once in 2017, right after I got doxxed, and then earlier a few months ago, and I realized we have absolutely nothing in common. And it sort of saddened me. You realize that most people go into the mainstream and they have a Netflix subscription and they, you know, that's what they do. And if you haven't done that, then you really are the outsider. And you can't, it's not surprising that most people have not made your choices. Most people have become consumers. They have become politically correct, and they take it as seriously as they're expected to take it. It's not sort of midway. They are really into, I mean, what we used to call political correctness, we now use the term wokery. It's there's no half measures with it, you know. It really consumes people.
No. And do you remember? You probably don't. You've probably erased it from your memory. But I distinctly remember reading articles by people like David Aronovich in about 2007, saying, A, that political correctness was pretty much over, but B, anyway, it was much overblown. It was just a form of politeness. And you think how political correctness has mutated into woke. It's become this all-consuming ideology, which begins at, well, I suppose, at school, but then completely infects all the universities. I mean, a sideline, I went to speak at the Oxford Union a few years ago, maybe about a decade ago, and I imagined in my head I was speaking to the Oxford Union that existed when I was at university, which was basically a sort of jolly debating society, and you were there to, you know, to entertain, I think, as much as anything. But now it was just really about policing your vocabulary and policing your metaphors and your analogies and so on. They were a significant chunk of the audience were there to subject you to the purity test, and if you failed, and I did obviously, they would burn you at the stake.
So it's not
it's extraordinary what we're living through now.
It really is, because that means that the debate is no longer an exploration of ideas or whatever. It's a test of whether your ideas, whether you are conformant to the only ideas that are acceptable. It's not, there's no curiosity. And of course, in theory, 18-year-olds, 20-year-olds, students at a very prestigious university should be among the most intellectually curious people in the world. They're really not. I mean, it's interesting how that can be completely subverted, and I think that is to do with the culture and the institution. You could make an 18-year, you know, a room full of 18-year-olds. I think you could shape them to be one way or the other, and the system shapes them to be this way. It shapes them to be, the junior wing of the party.
I was thinking what you were saying earlier about left and right. You know, I think this is kind of a distraction. This debate that what the left and what the right are doing. This is just I keep calling it pantomime. My wife gets really pissed off when I talk about this, but you know, I say, look, why are you reading the Telegraph? It's all just a charade. You know, why do you care what Boris is up to? It's all bollocks. But it's true. I think that it is impossible to underestimate the degree to which our entire culture, our entire civilization has been deliberately subverted over a period, not just of years, but of decades. Everything has been planned. Everything is planned and, you know, we talk about Gramsci, and we talk about, I know he didn't come up with the phrase, the long march through the institutions. You know, we talk about cultural Marxism, but the degree to which, I remember, for example, noting the dumbing down of our education system and thinking, what is going to happen when these kids have been taught diddly squat by their teachers, except, you know, politically correct values? What's going to happen when they grow up and enter the jobs marketplace and so on, and when they start becoming bosses, even, you know, what's it going to be like? And we are now living through that. We've got people who are educationally subnormal. I mean, they've been taught nothing, and then they've gone to universities, which no longer teach you to think critically. They no longer, you know, I mean, even if you go and study something like greats, you know, Latin and Greek.
Oh yeah, I think everything is doctrinaire nowadays.
Everything is. Yeah. And the kind of the Mail or Telegraph editorial line on this would be, we must do something about our woke universities. They don't champion freedom of speech, blah blah blah. But actually, this is not an accident. This is entirely deliberate that they are creating this new class of indoctrinated managerial types who are, I mean, you look at the corporate sector, you look at how much time they spend on diversity, sustainability, all this bollocks, which has got nothing to do with the core business. And it is an accepted part of every big business. Nobody is resisting, no one.
And now, this that is the thing. Sorry, I should interrupt. Go on.
No, you interrupt me. Go on, tell me.
Well, you know, as you say, the trouble with the right for the last 100 years has been that it constantly underestimates the scale and gravity of the problem that it's up against. And to say that, well, this particular university is really woke, yeah, because they all are. Well, then we should do something about it. Okay, what should we do about it? Complain. The complaint will be handled by an apparatchik. Do a media campaign. No journalist, no newspaper will carry that. They'll not talk about it. It'll be completely suppressed. Well, then we should start our own university. You will not get a bank account. If you do, it will get shut down and it will get demonized in the media. I don't think anyone really, well, obviously some people do understand the scale of it, but I think mainstream conservatives, it might be something intrinsic to them, or it might be just the nature of conservative discourse, really just don't know what they're up against.
Oh, totally. Do you remember Donal Blaney? In the days when I used to believe in left and right and conservatives and stuff, Donal Blaney used to run this madrasa for young conservatives, and he used to invite them to the Commons for, you know, to one of the meeting rooms for various MPs would address them, and I remember addressing them. And what struck me was that these people were not really interested in core beliefs at all. What mattered to them was what the currently fashionable position was in order to get on. And I'm afraid to say that that sort of careerist attitude, that complete lack of principle, infects the Conservative Party. And look at what we've seen now. It's only 2 years ago that I was doing, maybe 2.5 years ago, that I was doing podcasts with the Mogster, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Oh, he's a really sound conservative. He really believes in small government and tradition, and you know, he's a proper sound Tory. Bollocks. They are all sellouts. They will sell their mothers, their grandmothers, their children, in order to do whatever is necessary to get into the room where it happens. I mean, look at what's happened to Gove. Look at what's happened to look, or the what were they called? The Spartans. The Spartans who fought for that Brexit thing that we all thought mattered so much. We now realize counts for absolutely squat. It was a complete fucking waste of time.
Brexit. I think that Brexit was a symbolic thing more than anything else. It's kind of similar to how Trump. The opposition, the media and so on, really did not want Trump in office. But once he was in office, it didn't make any difference. I mean, he didn't do anything. He wasn't some, you know, fascist, racist president. He was completely stymied. But nonetheless, they really didn't want him there, for symbolic reasons. And in the same way, I think Brexit has had pretty much zero effect on how things actually happen. But nonetheless, it's a symbolic thing. And
well,
that,
do you know what? I get the impression I'm slightly further down the rabbit hole than you, Colin. I'm gonna probably sound like a wild conspiracy theorist.
I am holding back somewhat.
Are you?
But go on.
I think that Brexit was a psyop. I think that I believe Jennifer Arcuri, who was told, I think, by some insiders that the Brexit vote was significantly higher than 52-48. It was more like 70%. They rigged the ballots, the counting. And I think that the events of the last 2 years were all planned. But I think the events leading up to the last 2 years, I think they were getting their ducks in the row for this final globalist takeover that we're experiencing now. And I think that the purpose of Brexit primarily, which is, by the way, the purpose of almost all the things that people like George Soros spend their money on, is divide and rule. It was designed to sow division in our country, to set family against family, you know, a brother against sister, town against city, whatever. I'm sorry, town against country, whatever. It was, and look at it. I mean, I lost loads of friends over Brexit. People just wouldn't talk to me.
Yeah.
People actually, there's a woman who lives in one of the houses on the estate where I live down the road, used to invite us to dinner, you know, now cuts us dead when we meet her on walks and things. Now, but I mean, I've lost a lot more friends since over the shamdemic, but Brexit was the start of it. Brexit was we were sold a false prospectus. It was never going to make any difference. I mean, look, you think about this. I remember I was in a film called Brexit the Movie, and I was making we were all interviewed, you know, we Brexiteers, we all made these optimistic, positive cases for.
I think I remember amazing. This. It was part of the Leave campaign.
Good. Yeah. So Martin Durkin made it, and it was about all Britain was going to become like the Singapore of Europe. It was going to be like we were going to be finally able to cut loose from the shackles, from all this regulation and red tape and stuff. And it's going to be great. We were all going to be prosperous and happy and free. And there was that sense where I'd go into the place where I buy the dog food, you know, and these you know, these sort of solid sort of country working people were all behind Brexit, you know. And you could see why they were sick of the political class, and they were sick of bureaucrats dictating them how they should behave and what, you know, what regulations they had, and they were going to be free. And it was just all complete bullshit. It was just a con. That was never the plan. Look at what Boris has done. I shouldn't even call him Boris. That in itself is part of the trick. You know,
Josh. Yeah, or Bojo even. I mean, I like Bojo, but even to use it is to enter into this sort of jokey thing that obviously lets them away with things.
I knew the guy at Oxford, you know. I knew David Cameron. I smoked dope with David Cameron at Oxford. It's really weird. I mean, I've had this sort of Zelig like life where is that the right analogy? You know, I've bizarrely found myself friends with lots of people who've gone on to become important, influential politicians, you know, including two prime ministers. So I've seen these people up reasonably close, and I still can't quite understand what's happened. I don't understand what it is that I think essentially it's you know, the scene in the Bible where the devil takes Jesus up onto a high place and shows him the kingdoms of the world. He tempts him with the kingdom of the world. And I think that is summed up the world in our lifetime. People have just been shown these, what they can have if only they sell their souls, if only they do terrible things. And most of them are too happy to go for it.
Well, the promise of power, and yet, ironically, they don't seem to actually have much power. I mean, Boris, in fact, didn't you report that he had said to a bunch of senior journalists that he's just following orders?
Yes, that's right. He did. I think he, like much like David Cameron, you know, David Cameron was very much the same at Oxford. Extraordinary sense of entitlement among that particular class. the idea that, you know, oh, I've been a jolly good prime minister, and, you know, I think it's about much time I had a go at it, had a bash. that is very much that's how these people feel. And what they don't realize, I think, is that, like the American presidency, the whole system is rigged. You're not really, the democracy is an illusion. The decisions are being made on a much, much higher level. I mean, in the case of America, we know that it's not the president has no power. It's really the Federal Reserve and the central bankers and the shadow and the money laundering, drug running operations that are the CIA and the FBI. The presidency is just a sham. I'm sure something similar applies in this country and probably across the world.
It must do. It would be ridiculous. It would be strange if it didn't. I mean, I'm trying to think of a prime minister who actually does seem to have gone against the grain of the system, and I'm not sure. I think that Tony Blair did genuinely have vision of his own, or at least it coincided. I mean, I don't think he was just a slave. I think he was quite.
No. Well,
What do you think about that?
How dare they? Do you know what? I really, really object to people calling me. I'm quite old-fashioned. I think.
Tell them you're on Millennial.
If somebody's going to call you, they should call you on your bloody landline. The impertinence that people have when they just sort of think, "Oh, I can call you on your mobile."
Oh dear.
I suppose I'm quite old-fashioned in that way.
Well, I'm sorry. Just tell them to call back in an hour.
I didn't know. I just cancelled it. I don't know. It was somebody calling from abroad, I think. Anyway, it's annoying.
So Tony. Well, I said that I think Tony Blair was quite.
Oh yeah, what were you talking about there?
Well,
He's a Trotskyite.
Do you think he was just? Oh, I know. I'm not saying that he was a good guy or that his vision was laudable. I'm just saying I don't think he was just a sort of an apparatchik. I think he did actually want to reshape Britain.
Well, yeah, but that's not good, is it?
No, of course not. But what I mean is, I don't think he was just following orders. I think that was actually what he wanted.
Oh, no, definitely he was. Definitely, absolutely he was. Yeah. Look, you think about, I mean, I don't know how involved he was in 9/11. How much knowledge he had of that. Was he the Gulf War was like every war was engineered by the elites that control the world as a kind of money laundering operation. That's all these wars happen that way. Blair certainly. You think about what happened when Blair and Bush between them concocted the weapons of mass destruction excuse for going into destroy Saddam. That wasn't a principled.
Oh no, absolutely not. I would never claim that. I think let me be clear about this. I'm just saying I think he really did believe in gay rights, for example. I think he really did believe in multiculturalism. He really did believe in feminism. No, you don't think so? I think he was just a pragmatist.
Absolutely not. No more did he believe in gay rights than Gerry Adams believed in gay rights. I mean, I don't know whether you remember that there was a hideous video of Gerry Adams and possibly Martin McGuinness applauding some sort of gay marriage ceremony or something. And these are just bandwagons they jump onto. The whole gay rights thing, the whole transgender thing, these are all just ways of creating division in society. And weakening us and weakening our values, weakening family values and so on. It's all designed.
Oh, yes.
You take a step back. That all these policies are designed ultimately by people who hate us, who want to exploit us, who despise our values. They despise the family. They despise all the things that make life worth living, nationhood. Exactly. All the things that we strive for, all the things that make life worth living, they want to destroy. Blair was very much part of that. I mean, I think he's, you only have to look at his eyes now to realize that he's been demonically possessed for a considerable length of time. So no, I won't hear you say anything good about Tony Blair.
Because... Oh, I'm not saying that it's good. Not at all. All I was saying was my impression is that he really does believe what he says about, you know, gay rights and whatever. He's not just saying that because that's what's good for his career. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he just doesn't give a shit about anything at all and he's just doing whatever is good for his career.
Yes, I would say so. He's advancing. Look, I think there comes a point where people make a decision in politics. I mean, I think at the low level, they're just grunts. They haven't a clue what's going on. They really haven't. They rather like the idea of sitting in the House of Commons and having expenses and stuff, but it doesn't go much beyond that. Maybe they even have these idealistic notions that they can somehow serve their constituents and stuff. You know, they're that naive. But there comes a point where I think it is explained to them, if you want to get on, you have to sign up to, you've got to start working for the people who are really in charge. And in order to do that, you have to accept that the, you know, democracy, forget all your fancy notions about looking after everybody and everyone being equally valuable and so on. That's not how the world works and never has. The people in charge are these people. And if you want to get on, then you do what you're told and you advance their plans. So for example, environmentalism. I hate using the word the elite to describe these people because it implies that they're somehow special and good. And they're not. They happen to be people at the top. But let's call them the powers that be. The powers that be are very, very heavily invested in environmentalism as a means to skewing the system in such a way as to massively increase their power base and to crush the little people and to enrich themselves massively. So...
yeah,
the environmental movement is not really about saving the environment. Heaven forfend. I mean, it doesn't save the environment. It destroys it. You think about the damage that bat chomping, bird slicing, eco crucifixes do to the nature.
I loved it when you came up with that phrase, the eco crucifixes.
Yeah. Well, it's.
But I know it's not a funny thing. It's an obviously a grotesque thing.
Well, it's funny because it's true. That was my awakening moment, almost my Red Pill moment, where I looked into the origins of the environmental movement and I asked the question, why? Okay, suppose for a moment that it's if seems to be the case, there is no evidence to support catastrophic man-made global warming theory. There's no evidence at all, none, zilch. If that is the case, why is it that so many people, from academics to politicians to big businesses and stuff, are supporting this stuff? And you realize that we're looking at it the wrong way around. It's the all these environmental problems that we're constantly assaulted with in the newspapers every day. We're always being told the environment's in trouble. They are designed to drive us all towards these technologies which the powers that be are invested in. So wind turbines, you know, you can generate massive returns because the money ultimately comes from taxpayers and energy users. It's not like a free market thing. You know, they get given a guaranteed return, which of course is what every vulture capitalist dream, that they get guaranteed income courtesy of government fiat. Yeah. It's crony capitalism.
Yeah, it's like Big Pharma now. They've got guaranteed tens of millions of doses of the vaccine for each nation every single year.
That's how they roll. Regulatory capture. That, you see, that's the thing. These people do not like the vagaries of the free market. They hate the free market. They hate the idea that they might lose their money. They like that. Have you watched that documentary, drama documentary series, Dope Sick?
No.
About the the Sackler family. The Sackler family were the private shareholders of this company called Purdue Pharma. And Purdue Pharma produced this stuff. Was it Viacode?
OxyContin.
One of the opioids that has killed something like half a million Americans so far. You know, and ruined the lives of millions of others. So on Hula, which is a you can see on the Disney Channel, bizarrely. I mean, it's very un-Disney. There's this drama documentary about how the Sackler family, a guy called Richard Sackler, he'd inherited, they'd all inherited their shares in this company that their fathers and or grandfathers had bought. And you saw them in their big houses, and you can understand instantly why they would sell these dodgy products to the masses, because actually what mattered to them more than anything was keeping their nice big houses and having these lovely dividends that came their way every day. These people don't think in terms of sort of Christian responsibility to their fellow man or anything like that. They don't give a shit. Well, they're probably because they're it's not God that they serve anyway.
Again, I've interrupted. I'm sorry. It's just that there are so many things that I could pick up on. You just said that what they care about is profit, money. And that is undoubtedly true for a lot of these. And again, Big Pharma will have made an absolute unimaginable fortune from COVID, just like all these companies back in 2007 were making an absolute fortune from climate change stuff and throughout the 2010s. But I don't. I think that for a lot of this, it's a mistake to think, well, what the powers that be, what they really care about is profit and money and screwing the taxpayer and so on. It's really, I just don't think it's ultimately about money. For some of these lower level operators, of course, it's greed and whatever. But I think ultimately, it's a level above the money, profit seeking. It's power. It's a love of power in and of itself, and that might not be the top level, but I think it supersedes money. I mean, one of the things, of course, is go woke, go broke. That is not true. It's one of the things that libertarians love to say is, well, if Disney are going to make all these woke movies, then they'll go broke, but they never do. They never do go broke.
Oh, let's briefly talk about the disappointment of the lolbertarians.
I mean, God.
I think the last 2 years have tested to destruction the notion that libertarians have the solution to everything. If only we could let the market, assert itself, and common sense would be affirmed, and everything would turn out nice. That you think about the people from those think tanks like the IEA. Those so-called libertarians, Christopher Snowden and the rest of them. None of them have stood up to the vaccine tyranny. None of them have resisted the craziness that's happening to her. No, it really, I tell you what, I if somebody called me a libertarian, I'd reach for my shotgun.
it would be a very embarrassing thing. I mean, I just to make the point, sometimes go woke, go broke. Sometimes it does happen. Usually it doesn't. But even when it does happen, it's like they don't care. I think they will sacrifice profit in order to obtain power and to expand power. I think ultimately that's what it's about. And when you're talking about people at that level of that level of wealth, George Soros and Jeff Bezos.
Oh, no, he's just a bit yeah. player. I mean, look, you think about this. The Federal Reserve, created in 1913, basically gets to print its own money. It's a private bank which everyone thinks is the Bank of America that works hand in hand with government and acts in the interests of the American people, doesn't at all. It literally prints money for the banker elite, the banking families which founded the Federal Reserve at a secret meeting on Jekyll Island. And they all traveled by enclosed carriages so that they wouldn't be seen. And they snuck this thing under the radar. And so they don't need to, you're right, they don't need to make money to a degree. But it's odd because
I guess what I'm, sorry, you finished that thought.
Well, I say that what sort of slightly undermines that argument is that we know that the First World War, the Second World War, the two Gulf Wars, probably every war that's been, are essentially money-making enterprises for these people. I mean, you know, the Second World War, for example, Wall Street financed the Nazi war machine. I think the camp at Auschwitz was actually owned by an American company. I may be wrong, but certainly the American companies profited in the early stages of the war and financed Hitler's war machine.
I don't know about that, but one of the things that, I mean, while there undoubtedly is always profit to be made from war, wouldn't it be great if you could change the world and simultaneously make a profit? I think that's, and again, when you're at that level of society, that when you have that much power, you probably can wangle things so that you can make a profit and change the world at the same time. And I think that, again, with COVID, I think it's a similar thing. With climate change, a similar thing. With LGBT rights, even with World War II, you could say the same thing. That, and World War I, you could say the same thing. That, yeah, there's profit to be made from war, but those wars also radically reshaped European culture and European society, European politics, European economics, etc.
They don't care. That's the thing. We are dealing with psychopaths. They don't care about the cost in lives. They don't. You think about all the beautiful cities which were erased during the two world wars. I mean, you think about. There's nothing left of Germany, is there? You go to Germany.
It's heartbreaking.
And you're struck by how little architecture there is. Has been rebuilt.
It's modern. It's modern. Like the cities, like Cologne is hideous. Frankfurt is absolutely awful. Berlin, Nuremberg.
Go to Poland.
These are better, but yeah, I can't even imagine. I've never been to Poland.
If you go to Poland, there's no. Okay, so you go to English country houses. They're full of sturdy country chairs, wooden chairs, you know, from the 18th century or whatever. You go to Poland, there's no old furniture at all because it's all been burned to keep them alive during the war. But that's the thing. These people, the powers that be, do not care about their Philistines. The only way you can understand them is in terms of a kind of alien species that really hates us. I mean, do you ever listen to Cliff High? Cliff High.
Oh, no, I haven't heard of him.
He does a good podcast, Cliff High. But he thinks that so many of these collectivist ideologies, like communism, are so antithetical to what humans alike, you know, we don't naturally gravitate towards these systems where we're treated like ants. We're not individuals, and we value our individuality, and it's unnatural for us to be constrained by these systems. And Cliff's theory is that there is a kind of sort of insect-like intelligence which is coordinating this. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think that the people who are running this stuff are really, they're not like us. They're not human. at the top level.
Yeah, yeah. I think on the matter of collectivist ideologies, I mean, I think it's, I have a more nuanced take than that. I think that people want to belong to something, and that can be a nation, could be a race, could be a religion, or, and what we're seeing now with COVID is that it could be a social crusade. I think that people, just look at the way that the public have taken to COVID. There are, you know, vast numbers of people who, for the first time in their lives, they have something to contribute towards and something to believe in and something to help. Whereas they lived through the 90s and the 2000s as just individuals, just consumers. And it was unfulfilling. And now suddenly there's a way for them to you know, be part of something. Oh. You know,
But here's the thing. I said near the beginning that everything has been pre-planned. We have been brainwashed over a period of decades. So, for example, I mentioned this on another podcast. You remember, well, you can't avoid them, all those sodding children in need campaigns with that stupid bear, Pudsey. The idea is that you're meant to, that it's, that your self-worth can be found through spunking your money on these dubious causes, which, you know, you've got Lenny Henry in an African village and you think, well, gosh, that involves black people, that must be good because we're told that black people are special and we should, you know, this is clearly a worthy cause, and I should feel a bit of guilt as a white man as well. And, you know, we are so conditioned into these responses, and one of the responses we're conditioned into is this thing called pathological altruism. Where it's altruism to the nth degree. And you'll notice how this has come to fruition in the marketing of COVID and the marketing of the pandemic, that we do all these stupid things not to save ourselves, we don't take a vaccine to boost our immune system. It's to stop granny dying. It's to stop, you know, it's to save the NHS.
Exactly. Well, that's
why should
another
we give
thing.
A shit about the NHS? The NHS is a kind of socialist monolith, which you know, a throwback to the post-war era. It's got no place in the modern world. It's a massive, it's a parasite. It's a gaping maw, utterly insatiable. It's destroying our national finances and has done long ago. It's also a kind of training ground for the left. I mean, you know, doctors automatically become left-wing because they start believing that the only form of healthcare is when it's allocated by a socialist state, which ain't so, but that's what they come to believe. Because I don't think doctors are as bright as we're led to believe. So what's happened now in the last 2 years could not have happened, or could not have happened so effectively, without all the conditioning that led up to it. You see?
Yeah, of course. I think that one thing that one has to bear in mind is that what has happened over the last 2 years has happened in all across the West, in every country, including those that don't have the NHS, for example. I mean, the NHS, I think, is the only free at the point of use healthcare system. That's something that amazes me about COVID, how effective it's been, how adaptive it has been, or those implementing it have been. Every country, every national theatre has been adapted to, and it has worked. It's quite staggering how successful it's been. Acclimatizing to the local culture. With Britain, the NHS has served as a sort of hook to, well, you want to save the NHS, and we all love the NHS, and you wouldn't want to overburden it. You wouldn't want to stretch it to breaking point, so that then granny dies. But then the NHS itself becomes a priority rather than an instrument. It becomes something like a goal in itself, a worthy thing to protect and defend when it should be used. I mean, that's what it's for, in theory.
You made me think, actually, of what you were saying earlier about how times have changed. Do you remember that period where a lot of conservative MPs, including senior ones, would express reservations about the NHS as a kind of, you know, because obviously it is seriously flawed, and they would say it needed reform, and then there came a point where they stopped doing that, and where they, you know, if you cut them in half, you'd see NHS in the middle, like a stick of rock.
I think this came with the advent of David Cameron. I think he must have made a pragmatic decision that this is a hill we don't need to die on, so we'll just support the
NHS. His handlers encouraged him towards that pragmatic position. I really don't believe that these people have any autonomy. I think that's the big shock they get when they come into Downing Street and they realize that, you know, yeah, you think you're prime minister, you think it's a big deal, mate, you have no bloody clue. You're just a puppet. I think
David Cameron, in contrast to what I said about Tony Blair, I think David Cameron really didn't have any ideas at all or any vision for society. That's an embarrassing thing about conservative prime ministers and conservative governments, is that they, with the possible exception of Margaret Thatcher, they don't seem to have any vision for what they want to do with the country, whereas the left they've got radical ideas. They've got a definite vision. And indeed, conservatives seem to be opposed to the very idea of wanting to do something with the country. It's like, but the trouble with that is that seeds the ground to the left. And I know that these labels are obviously antiquated at this point, but still, I think they have some use still.
You see, I just don't. The last 2 years have been such a massive eye-opener for me. I don't believe that these things have any meaning, and probably never did.
Yeah.
It's all an illusion.
I think that, well, obviously there are the personalities of left-wing politicians. They tend to be a bit quite different, and their ideas are different. Their beliefs, their professed beliefs are different from those professed by right-wing conservative politicians. And likewise, they appeal to different sectors of the population. The more feminine, the more community-minded will vote left, will vote Labour, and so on. So that, to that extent, I think those labels still have purchase, at least up until 2019. But I do agree with you that, you know, from March 2020 onwards, we've been living in a new world. I do agree with you on that.
Yeah, but we were living in that new world. Look at what happened after Brexit. And Brexit was in 2016, wasn't it? And you think about what happened in the years leading up to Johnson's becoming prime minister, and to in order to end the impasse that had held up, you know, when you had Burko and his posturing and clearly acting in favour of the Remain faction in Parliament, and the civil service ganging up to frustrate Brexit and make it much, much harder, and the French negotiations and, you know, the negotiations with Barnier and so on. I think we realised then that You may think you're voting for shit, but you don't actually get it delivered because there's a system you're fighting, and the system is geared against us, and it's not about left or right. It's about them versus us.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I think that ultimately democracy is a sham, I do agree with what you were saying earlier about the machinations of politicians, the sort of soap opera of, well, he's fallen out with him and she's plotting against that one. And what are they going to do next?
Yeah.
What's going to happen in the next exciting episode?
For example, do you really believe that? Do you believe that woman had an affair with Matt Hancock? I don't.
I have no idea.
She was an old friend. I mean, the whole camera footage was obviously completely, it was a complete setup. In the same way, the story about the Christmas party. I think that was, a fabrication. And yet people lap up this stuff because they think, well, yeah, we've got you now. We've got you now. And
but why would that that be fabricated, though? To what end?
Which one?
The Christmas party.
The Christmas party. I mean, I'm not saying that they didn't have a Christmas party. I mean, that we know that the political class has been taking the piss. But then you could have made the same. Why did people not go bigger on the G7 summit, where again there was this massive hypocrisy, where they were wearing masks for the photographs, and then they were mingling thereafter.
That's so true. And also, why was the footage of that woman speaking? I've forgotten, Allegria or whatever her name was.
Yeah.
Why was it only released? Allegra Staten. Why was it only released a year after the press conference?
Why do they hold on for it a year? And why also an ITN crew? These people are dependent for their stories on their cozy relations with Downing Street. They're not gonna leak a story like that without very, very, very good reason. I think it was also there are questions about where it was filmed. The revamped room with the blue drapes and the wooden paneling that hadn't been done at the time it was supposed to have been filmed, unless they built this thing and then hid it for 3 months and then why would they do that? If you look at the timeline, you look at when they announced that they were going to do this thing and when they actually when they unveiled this room to the public. There's lots about the story that doesn't add up. And why did it become such a big story? Well, it's that things don't become a story. Stories, news stories, do not have this intrinsic value which screams, "I am a really important news story. I should be everywhere." It's purely an editorial judgment, and there was something very, very suspicious about the editorial judgments, which said, "This is the story we're going to go massive on, all of us." All of the media, it's coordinated. It's just
here's a theory I've heard about this, that Matt Hancock was discredited for having an affair with his secretary, when, you know, I can only imagine how many affairs are going on with secretaries throughout Whitehall and Westminster. I mean, it must be a fairly normal thing. Matt Hancock was discredited. Dominic Cummings was discredited and shamed and all that. And then this, and then Boris Johnson himself has been cast as a sort of buffoon, and I think he is a buffoon, to be fair, but still, he's been demonized. So that's at least four attacks on the government, specifically to do with COVID, the people involved with the COVID agenda. So someone might well think, well, that proves that the media is impartial about COVID, because it's attacking these politicians who are central to that effort. But another theory I've heard is that actually this is coming from higher than the national level, and it's a way for globalist powers to undermine national governments and make them seem incompetent, corrupt, etc.
They don't to work very hard to do that. I mean, they are.
Of course.
I think. Look at Jacinda Ardern with her crack pipe. Look at Scott Morrison in Australia. Look at President Bieber in Canada. I mean, look at Joe Biden. You know, the guy he's a vegetable. He's a cabbage in the White House, in the Oval Office. There are some really, really third-rate people in politics, and they're there for a reason. They're there because they are malleable. That they're just meat puppets.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I guess you could question, well, how has that situation come about? I mean, is that a function of democracy that it ends up elevating the mediocre in some way? I don't know. Or has that been deliberately engineered so that globalist powers could outwit the national government?
Yeah, I think so. I think, look, we are talking about people who have their tentacles in everything. And of course, I'm not saying that they can plan everything down to the last detail. Nobody can do that. But they've got enough money and enough influence that if they cast the line in enough places, they're going to pull in a few fish. That's how it works.
Yeah, I also think if you have enough power, then you don't need to cover every detail, because you can just paper over the cracks and you can just insist on your narrative. It doesn't matter. The contradictions don't matter. This is something, again, you see this with COVID, that it's rife with contradictions that to the public simply don't matter, because they've been told that, yes, you know, the media has covered it.
Yeah. It's, in a way, it's part of the kind of the fuck you, the powers that be. In the same way, Theodore Dalrymple's described this in about life in behind the Iron Curtain in the communist era, that the state knows that you know that what they're saying is complete bullshit, and that is part of the insult to you, that you are forced to go around living this lie that you know is a lie and they know you know is a lie.
Theodore Dalrymple said this about political correctness. This is one of his, probably the most famous quote from Dalrymple about, you're familiar with Theodore Dalrymple, aren't you? I think you once had didn't you have an interview with him once?
No, I've never met him, but you know, we used to, I'm a fan of his work.
All right, yeah. His most famous quote, I would say, is the one about political correctness being primarily a form of humiliation. It's not even about insisting on certain beliefs in the populace. It's about degrading the populace by forcing them to go to pretend to believe certain things.
Yeah. Yes. Well, exactly. Well, and masks, of course, are very much that. You know, we know from the studies, the Denmark study with 6,000 people, that masks make no difference to the transmission or protecting you from the COVID virus.
Well, Fauci himself said that.
Yeah, the Fauci said it. So the politicians in this country, I think even the WHO said it. And yet still they we have mask mandates. And it's like... And in a way, I think the fact that they've given you an exemption clause in a way is part of the scam. They're saying, okay, we're going to give you an exemption, but let's see how many of you are brave enough to want to stand out, out without a mask. I think most of you would rather cover your face.
And demonstrably, they're correct. They're correct because, you know, the vast majority of people don't use that medical exemption, even though it's very easy to do it. It's very easy to just say, I've got medical exemption. And that's all you need to say. They're not allowed to ask the details of it. All you need to say is the two words, medical exemption. And and hardly anyone does it. And that's a fascinating example of, you know, human nature, the need to conform.
You see, you go to the petrol station and you see people just like almost as a, without thinking about it, getting their masks on, you know, and slipping them on as they go to pay for their petrol. Or people, I go to the supermarket and I'm the only person without a mask. It's extraordinary. And you look at some of these people, you see people that, young men who are, I think they're a bit tasty, you know, like Jack the Lad, or well turned out young men who probably fancy themselves as, you know, thinkers, and they're all wearing masks. You know, you kind of think, well, you're a dick, you're not cool.
It's sad as well, because you think that you're in the prime of your life, you're a young man, the last thing you need to worry about is coronavirus, and yet they go along with it. It's like it's thwarting, you know, masculinity at that age. It's very sick. I'm not sure if there was something earlier that I wanted to clarify, but I've forgotten what it was now. I think we are more in agreement. I'm just sort of being very nitpicky, I guess. I agree that we are living in very much an engineered world, and we have been for a long, like many decades now. certain things that have been allowed to happen in order to complicate and muddy the picture have been allowed to happen for just that reason. Although I don't think that everything is like that. I think there have been, probably there have been some errors, some screw ups, but whatever. We do seem to be in a very artificial world, and a world that draws people away from their natural instincts. I mean, you, for God's sake, you've got, you know, young women who have no interest in becoming mothers. That is difficult to think of anything that could be less natural than that. What could be more natural than the drive for women to become mothers? The maternal instinct. So clearly we live in a very perverse world. But I don't want to sort of leave people. I mean, how much longer do you want to go on for?
I think we should, if you don't mind, I think, because I've been feeling quite ill today, and find it quite a drain.
Okay. So, well, I guess we should, let me just ask you a few questions from the audience then, and then we'll wrap it up. Because there were several.
Definitely.
Okay. Just a tip to say thank you, Woz, for all your efforts. Millennial is a great tradition now. And thank you, James. I think I speak for many a lurker when I say it's great to know that you're not alone in your thoughts. Merry Christmas. And then someone said, COVID has filled the vacuum created by the implosion of Christianity. Would you have anything to say about that?
Say that again.
COVID has filled the vacuum created by the implosion of Christianity.
Yeah. I think that applies not just to COVID, but to environmentalism as well. That if you kill Christianity, which is effectively what's happened since the melancholy long withdrawing roar from Dover Beach, it doesn't get replaced with nothing. It gets replaced with other religions, and environmentalism, I think, has replaced Christianity to a degree. But I suppose the relevance of COVID is that Christianity teaches you that death is not something to be feared, and that there is, you know, there is an afterlife, and that this is a transient period on this earth. And of course, what we've been encouraged to do in COVID is to fetishize life at all costs, you know, even the lives of people who've had long, long lives. I mean, by any historic standards, people living in that, people dying at 82, it can't really be called a tragedy. And yet we've decided to sacrifice our education system, our children's futures, our economy, our jobs, our freedoms, on the basis that we cannot let anyone who's 80 with various underlying conditions die of this sort of baddish flu. So the absence of Christianity has definitely helped.
Yeah, it's crazy, because it used to be something that we just expected people in their 80s to do, you know, to die. Whereas now it's seen as some kind of hideous aberration. It's as you say, a tragedy, when it really isn't.
It really isn't. But actually, the corollary of that, I mean, what's happened in the last 2 years is there has been the most extraordinary Christian awakening, as people have begun to realize that what is happening is ultimately the battle between good and evil. What's going on is evil. And I think that people go through a stage. I went through this. They go from the red pill stage to the black pill stage, when they realize that things are far, far worse than they ever imagined. And then finally, if they choose, they go to the white pill stage and realize that actually there is hope after all, that ultimately God will see us right.
Yeah, I think that there is this, I agree with you that we are up against, this is a battle between good and evil. Ultimately, that's what we're talking about here. That's, and everything else just fits into that that overall pattern. No matter how
it makes it much easier.
It does
fight the fight.
When you've
got spiritual armor on, it makes a huge difference. In fact, I'm not sure without the spiritual armor you're really in the game, because this is, you're up against it, and you need that. You need that help. You need that supernatural help.
Another question. Ron Paul and the libertarians are still out there pushing back against COVID mandates and tyranny. People just aren't interested like they were in 2008, 2012. Why is that? Why is there a less interest in libertarianism nowadays?
Well, I mean, Ron Paul wrote that book, didn't he? End the Fed. I mean, he's been on top of it. I think part of the problem is that libertarian arguments are kind of not up to the job of dealing with what's happening right now. These are debates of 10 years ago.
We have
the wholesale dismantling of our civilization, and you're worried about, you know, well, I mean, I'm not saying the Federal Reserve doesn't matter, it really does. Yeah, you're worried about tax cuts. You know, the idea that if only you write enough funny, well-honed articles about the virtues, you know, Dan Hannan does it all the time. If articles worked, then we would be having low tax right now, because the arguments for low tax are, I mean, you can't argue with them. They are unarguable. And yet still the machine grinds on.
Yeah, I think it's because they're not. It's difficult to be romantic about. It's difficult to get excited about low taxes, but it's easy to get romantic about the idea of equality, or the idea of, on the other side, the idea of nationhood, the idea of religion, your religious faith. These are things I think people need to feel engaged and excited about something. People don't get excited about economics. They just don't.
Well, it's odd, though. I find that because actually I think I could make a very sexy case for low taxes, and that is ultimately about personal autonomy and about freedom. And what could be more important than personal autonomy and freedom? You know, we all have a right to express ourselves, and we're all different. And who'd want to live in a world where we are crushed by the system? I think you can make a case. I don't think it's that. I don't think it's that the arguments are not sexy, or even
what I mean is
the emotions. I still maintain I'm further down the rabbit hole than you. I just think that the system is geared towards crushing us, crushing our spirits, taking away our freedoms, taking away our money, and that's why the equality idea gets funded, because equality is divisive. Low tax is not funded because it's not in the interests of the cabal, basically.
Boris Johnson said, "I won't be taking orders from the Davos crowd," prior to getting elected. What happened? Was he taken into a back room, told who was in charge, and given his orders? I think you covered this earlier, but if there's anything you'd like to add?
Well, yes. I think the thing you have to remember with Boris is that he's an actor. He lies routinely. And think who his father is. His father is in it up to the neck in Rockefeller. And he's a Malthusian. He's very much on board with the globalist plan, the Great Reset. Now, maybe because he was busy philandering around the world, the awful Stanley didn't have any influence on his son, but I suspect he did. I think the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. So I don't think we can trust anything Boris says about anything, and we cannot be sure that it all went wrong when he had his alleged bout of COVID and he was taken into a room and he disappeared from view. I mean, maybe he was given a good talking to, but it could equally be that he was corrupted a lot long before then.
Oh, I'm sure he was. I have to say, just on the conspiratorial angle, I remember thinking at the time, really, the Prime Minister's got COVID and he's gonna isolate for 3 weeks. How convenient. Yeah. It just seemed strange to me. It seemed too good to be true. Okay, how much would I have to pay James to get him to stop eating meat in order to fight global warming? Loving the stream, gentlemen. I think this is a sarcastic question.
Yeah, you can't buy me. Well, I had a similar argument with Tobes. Not an argument. We're saying how much would I have to be paid to take the clot shot? I wouldn't do it for 100 million.
So you really think, you really see it as there is no pragmatism here. The clot shot, the vaccine is, it would be the injection of evil into your person, into your body.
It's a kill shot. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So there's no half measures.
No.
Okay. Finally, James, you have defected from the mainstream. Can we expect to see more high profile defections in the future?
That's a difficult one. I'd probably say no. They're a bunch of cowards. They're too busy. It was interesting. The last podcast interview I did with Douglas Murray, he called me a kamikaze conservative, saying that I didn't care about reputational damage or being politic. That I would, you know, set my Mitsubishi Zero's controls for the bridge of the aircraft carrier and just dive for it. And that is kind of how I am. I don't think most people are. They're just a bunch of bedwetters.
That sounds like he was saying you care more about the truth and principles than about self-preservation.
Sorry?
It sounds like he was saying you care more about truth and principles than self-preservation.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, yeah. And most people don't have... I mean, I don't know why. I don't know why this has happened to me. I really don't. I think I'm kind of on a kind of holy mission, you know, to tell the truth and tell it like it is. And most people are on that mission. Most people are about saving their skin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's disappointing, isn't it? But it does make you think. It does make you think, well, okay, then I kind of have to do this because so few other people are.
Well, I find it very easy to do because all you've got to do is tell the truth. Hmm. Okay. Why can't more people do that?
I know. I know. it's like... Why do you have to be corrupt? Why do you have to be dishonest? Why do you have to be cowardly? It's like you want to ask people, can't you just
but you
be
see,
a good person?
I pondered for years when I was at Oxford. You know, I used to wonder why it was that I wasn't admitted into these, you know, the really high level. You know, why wasn't let into the Bullingdon and stuff, and why and the reason is that I think people spotted something in me, which is that I won't play the game. I don't like playing the game. I mean, I like it up to a point. I like wearing the clothes and stuff, and I like, you know, I like shooting, I like hunting and stuff, but when push comes to shove, I won't engage in the kind of necessary hypocrisy. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, I hope this attitude works out for you. I mean, I hope that it doesn't. You know, I hope that Douglas Murray was wrong.
It doesn't result in me being found hanged. That's how they have suicide, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. I hope that it doesn't end up being a kamikaze mission, as Douglas Murray put it.
Well, you know, what can you do? I mean, you know, what's the alternative? Lie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you've seen this stuff, you can't unsee it, can you?
No. All right. Okay. Well, let's leave it there. And I think this has been a really nice talk. And thank you very much for
appearing
on
Millennial.
Well, thank
you for having me on your show. I've loved doing it.
Okay. Well, maybe we can do it again sometime.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This was James Dellingpole on Millennial 2021. I'll be back in about half an hour with the next stream. But James, thank you for appearing.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.